En podcast från Aftonbladet Ledare.
Demokratin utmanas i världen. I mer än hälften av världens länder går det bakåt. Det menar Internationell Idea, en internationell organisation baserad i Stockholm. Och jag sitter här med generalsekreteraren Kevin Casas Zamora som vistar oss idag. Välkommen! Intervjun kommer att hållas på engelska. Welcome, Mr. Secretary General.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
For how long have you been in Sweden?
I've been living in Sweden for nearly 7 years now. Very happy years, I have to say.
I think most Swedish people doesn't know what International IDEA is and that it's based here in Stockholm. Could you tell us a little bit about what the organization does?
Of course, International IDEA is an international organization made up and supported by 35 countries from around the world, from every region. And it's a very diverse crowd that includes huge democracies, small democracies, highly industrialized, developing, and everything in between. And for 31 years, the Institute founded, as you mentioned, here in Stockholm and still headquartered in Stockholm, has supported democracy in fundamentally in a couple of ways. On the one hand, it is a policy research institute, a think tank that works on elections, constitutions, gender equality issues, regulation of money in politics, impact of digital technologies on democracy. Among other things. And on the other hand, it provides technical assistance on those same issues all over the world.
So, but if you could sort of explain what is different from International IDEA from other international organizations like the OSCE, the European Council, the UN?
Well, I mean, our main difference is that our sole mandate is to support democracy. We don't do anything else. Just supporting democracy in, as I said, in a couple of ways all over the world, and with the support of our member states, including, of course, Sweden.
So, how is it going?
The institute is going well. I mean, it's a very important part, I would say, of Sweden's contribution to the global cause of democracy. But as I said, it's not merely Sweden. I mean, this is a coalition of countries trying to support democracy in a variety of ways. And we're doing what I would think is important work, good work to support elections, to support parliaments, to support the basic bricks of democracy all over the world.
Last year, you produced a report with the name Global State of Democracy 2025. It's also on your webpage. But it's clearly saying that the state of democracy is going backward. In the data, you point that in half of the world's countries, the situation has been deteriorating on at least one area the last 5 years. If you would sort of say how serious is the situation, what would you say?
That is the most challenging situation for democracy, I would say, since the decade of 1930, I would say. We haven't seen such strong headwinds in our lifetimes. So it is a very serious concern. And it's a global concern.
And the 1930s ended with the Second World War.
True. I hope that history will not repeat itself, but is a sign of how serious we should take the global plight of democracy.
And when you, in your report, point out these risks, what you see also very clearly, if you count the number of people living in those countries, you see there is very big countries that go backward. It's China. It's also in India. But a country that many people here are worrying about is the United States. What could you say of the state of democracy in the United States?
It's very concerning. I would say that the situation of democracy in the United States is arguably one of the most concerning factors in the global situation of democracy. This, of course, has been going on for a while. The negative trends in democratic performance in the U.S. predate the arrival of Trump in the political stage, but both Trump administrations, particularly the current one, have turbocharged those negative trends in a variety of ways.
And what are those trends?
Currently, most visibly, the erosion of the rule of law in the United States, the normalization of political violence, and internationally, the fact that the U.S. has, for all intents and purposes, switched sides. I mean, whereas the U.S. was a very strong driving force in the global expansion of democracy over the previous 70 years, with all sorts of flaws and all sorts of double standards and hypocrisy. It's very difficult to understand the global expansion of democracy, but without mentioning that the preeminent geopolitical power was a liberal democracy. That has changed dramatically. I mean, in the U.S.
When you say switch sides, which side had the U.S. switched to?
I would say the U.S. at the very least has become indifferent to the fate of democracies around the world. And in many cases is providing inspiration and providing cover to authoritarian or would-be authoritarian leaders all over the world.
If you, in your report, you point out many different factors that contribute to the deterioration of democracy, what would you say is the most important factor of those that makes democracy deteriorate?
I think it's a combination of factors. I mean, you cannot point to a single cause, but it's a case of a death by a thousand cuts. Hopefully not death, but I would say extreme polarization is one. Extreme inequality is another one. Corruption and perceptions of corruption are hugely important in the global plight of democracy. A widespread perception that democracy is not delivering in the way expected by societies. And I would say an international environment that is less hospitable to the protection of democracy. I mean, nowadays...
So it's not one factor?
No, not at all. I think it's a convergence of very, very complicated factors that make up for a kind of perfect storm that we are witnessing all over the
world. One of the things you're pointing at in the report is the press situation for press freedom.
Yes.
That's specifically going backwards. Could you give examples on that?
They're all over the world. Actually, last year when we published the report, the single most important finding in the report was that the proportion of countries that over the previous 5 years had seen a very significant deterioration in press freedom was the largest over the past half a century. So this is enormously concerning, because when press freedom suffers is, in a way, the canary in the coal mine. I mean, when press freedom suffers, accountability suffers, and many other aspects of democracy suffer.
Is this
suffer.
A bug or is it a feature? I mean, is this the driving force behind the development, or is this, what is this? How should
no,
we interpret?
No, I mean, it is. I guess it's kind of a negative cycle. I mean, I don't think that press freedom is the origin of the problem. In any way, in some ways, is the manifestation of previous of a previous intent to weaken checks and balances in many countries, because the press is a fundamental check on political power. But to the extent that press freedom is weakened, the process of weakening of democracy accelerates. And this is something that we are seeing in all, you know, regions in the world. And this is very important. Let me insist on this point that, you know, before, whenever we used to have these discussions, we would say, oh, well, you know, the problems of democracy are to be found in young democracies or in developing democracies. That's not true anymore. I mean, the global plight of democracy is global, right? Is something that you see in every region, is something that you see that cuts across development levels, that cuts across a democracies that have been very consolidated as well as young democracies. So it's truly a global problem that demands global answers.
But if you look at Europe, we have a few basket cases here. We have Poland, we have Hungary.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, this gives also some hope. Both these countries have changed government. Now we have a new situation in Bulgaria instead. But it's something that changed for the better. How would you analyze why is this happening? In a way, it goes against the trend, if you say so.
In some ways, but not in others. I mean, one important fact about democracy globally is that the demand for democratic governance remains very strong. I mean, when you see global opinion surveys, well over 70% of the global population says that they prefer to be governed democratically. So the demand is there. The real challenge posed by the cases of Poland, of Hungary, you can mention Brazil as well, is that sometimes we tend to think that once there is a critical election and pro-democracy forces prevail, that's the end of the problem. And we go back to the, you know, to the status quo before the pro-authoritarian forces came along. It's much more complicated than that. I mean, this is something that you see in the case of Poland, where trying to untangle all the things that happen in the years that the populist authoritarian government was in power is enormously, enormously difficult. As difficult it will be in Hungary as well, despite the big majority of the government. So this is, in a way, you know, once the virus of authoritarian populism attacks the body politic, is there to stay. And this becomes a constant battle that you have to fight.
But do you think this is some temporary change, or do you think that this is kind of a watershed situation where this development now will continue and that we will in the end only have a few spots with democracy left?
No, I mean, what I see is that is the presence of authoritarian populism will become a feature of our political systems. And to that extent, it is a daily battle that needs to be fought and won.
But could I because from in a European perspective, you see the second, I mean, you see phases of democratization.
Yeah.
You see, after the First World War, there was one phase of democratization with many countries, among them Sweden, with general suffrage and so on. After the Second World War, you had a new wave of democratization. Yeah. After the Berlin Wall fell, you had a third wave of democratization. So you tend to see the history as developing in stages, and then in the end, everyone is democratic. So why is this happening now?
Again, it's a variety of factors that are converging in a...
Yeah, but why do you think the perfect storm is now? Why wasn't the perfect storm 10 years ago? Why wasn't it in 10 years? Is it Trump?
No, I don't think so. I think it's it's impossible to have this discussion without making reference to social media. But also, quite frankly, and we don't talk enough about this, about the grotesque levels of inequality that we see globally and increasingly. I mean, the kind of extreme concentration of wealth that we are seeing, and now, you know, it's very glaring, it's very visible, particularly around, big digital technologies and the enormous wealth that that's generating, the enormous concentration of wealth that that's generating. Some of those phenomena that we are seeing are completely incompatible with any functioning democracy.
But if you look at the European perspective once more, are you positive about the future or are you negative? I mean, what do you think the development will be?
I'm cautiously optimistic. I still think that the fundamental case for democracy remains very strong. I mean, democracy is the one political system that fundamentally respects the dignity and the agency of human beings. But it also it resolves in a very elegant way a problem that authoritarian systems always have difficulty coping with, which is the problem of political succession. And on top of that, and perhaps fundamentally, it has a capacity for self-correction that is arguably its strongest attribute. So the fundamental case for democracy remains very strong. What needs to happen, and this is perhaps the fundamental action point here, is that if you want to defend democracy for the next generation, you have to reform the way in which democracy functions now. And you have to take seriously some of the driving forces behind the global plight of democracy, like inequality.
If you would, you have said inequality, we discussed press freedom a little bit earlier. If you would say what kind of reforms that needs to be done, what are the most important reforms that, for example, the European Union can do, that other countries can do in order to sort of come back on track when it comes to democracy? Because it's a political question which reforms are undertaken.
Sure. I would say when it comes to inequality, let's start with the bare minimum, which is, and this is, I mean, it never ceases to amaze me that we haven't been able to do something about tax havens, which remain a sore wound in the working of the world as a whole. I mean, this is unacceptable from every standpoint, but it's one of the examples of extreme concentration of wealth that is almost inherently inimical to the working of democracy. So let's start with something very basic. So taking inequality seriously, but also I have to think, I mean, we haven't, mentioned the question of disinformation and the erosion of truth and trust. That is another key aspect of this.
How do you reform that? What kind of political tools would you say is available?
In the case of disinformation, some of the things that the Nordic countries are doing are pretty fundamental and exemplary. I mean, ultimately, it's a question of civic education and digital literacy among the population. I mean, if you don't spend a lot of effort in helping people to identify reliable sources of information from unreliable sources of information, to tell the wheat from the chaff, to tell a truth from lies and from alternative realities, you won't be able to succeed, and democracy will ultimately falter.
But if you look at the, as a question of how to do reforms in this area, we have a fundamental problem in Europe with Russian disinformation around the Ukraine war. This is, and of course, the Nordic countries have been targets of this.
Sure,
I'm not sure it works so much, but it's at least the Russians are. It's not for the lack of trying. The Russians are trying
all the time.
How do you construct that on a European level, would you say? Because it's quite effective in Germany, for example. It works fine. They have AfD, which is a pro-Russian party, which is, in some opinion polls, at least the second largest party, or maybe even the largest.
I mean, whether that's the result of Russian disinformation or not is debatable. I think, you know, there are many, many drivers behind the rise of the populist right in Europe, as elsewhere. Because I come from a region that is currently seeing, from Latin America, that is currently seeing a resurgence in far-right political options. So there are many drivers to this. It's not just Russian disinformation. And when it comes to Russian disinformation, and since you're in the lookout for positive examples, you have the example of Moldova that just happened, where an election took place, and that was heavily targeted by Russia, and yet the pro-democratic forces, against a veritable onslaught of Russian disinformation, managed to win the day. So it is possible. I'm not saying that it's easy to do that, but it is a winnable battle.
But here's inequality, disinformation, or social media, or whatever information's where. Do you have any more examples of reforms that you could do?
One crucial aspect in all of this is we need to protect electoral integrity, which is the bedrock of democracy, for a variety of reasons. I mean, the most obvious one is that because if you don't have credible elections, the rest of the democratic construct really doesn't matter. But more fundamentally, and this goes to the example of Hungary and the example of Poland and the example of Brazil and many other examples around the world, I would say that when you lose the ability to drive meaningful political change through the ballot box, you're no longer a democracy. So protecting this ability of democratic elections to generate meaningful political change is what separates a country like Hungary from a country like Venezuela, where, you know, a couple of years ago Maduro could steal an election daylight.
But this is also one of the areas in your report where you point out that there is a great deterioration.
And
we have seen in the United States how you now redraw constituency boundaries and where you basically change the fundamentals of the midterm elections. Would you consider the United States a democracy now?
Under severe challenges, but it is a democracy. I think it is still possible to... we'll find out when the midterm elections come, we'll find out if meaningful political change is still possible through the ballot box. I would like to think that it is possible, but ultimately it is an empirical question, and we'll find the answer to that question in November.
I would like to see, it doesn't sound completely sure. It's more or less an opening for something else. If you look at the report, you point out election integrity is under severe risk.
It is.
If all these legislation passes about the new constituency boundaries, maybe ICE attacks people that votes and so on, would you consider that election a democratic election?
It will be an election held under severe challenges, just as severe as the election that was just held in Hungary, which nonetheless led to big political change.
So you compared the U.S. in this situation with the Hungarian situation.
I'm not saying that it's the same, but it might lead to a similar situation in which the ability of the opposition to contest an election is hamstrung and put at risk. Sometimes the will of the population to restore democracy is so strong and the dissatisfaction with the incumbent is so strong that it manages to prevail. So, again, it is an empirical question whether a significant political change will happen in the U.S. As a result of the midterm elections. I mean, we'll see. I'm still hopeful, but I cannot give you assurances that that will be the case, which is in itself very troubling, for sure.
Which is in itself very...
Absolutely.
Very clear answer also. If we go to Sweden, in the other part of the world, how would you say Swedish democracy, the health of Swedish democracy today?
I mean, look, according to almost any indicator, Sweden does very well. It's not without challenges, because no democracy these days is without challenges. And some of the challenges that we're seeing in Sweden are long-standing and some are more recent. But all in all, the health of the of Swedish democracy remains very strong. But, you know, if you want to talk about the challenges, I mean, I can mention a few. One of the things that we're seeing in our indicators is that over the past 20 years, there has been an erosion in press freedom in Sweden. Some of the challenges are more recent. I would say that polarization levels in the Swedish debate are very high and increasing, and that's happening in a variety of places around the world. But I, to be very honest with you, I didn't expect to see it the way I've seen it in Sweden. I mean, that has been a surprise.
So it was worse than you thought?
Yeah. I mean, the level of polarization, the fact that politics in Sweden is as tribal as it is, has come as a surprise to me.
Because in your report, you point out polarization, you point out disinformation as a factor.
Disinformation is
the role of social media in Swedish.
Exactly. I mean, disinformation, I mean, part of the deterioration in press freedom in Sweden is connected to online harassment, to threats to journalists. You know, these are things that are eroding press freedom in Sweden, and some of them are connected to the digital world and the what's happening with social media. Compared to the strengths of Swedish democracy, I have to say that comparatively speaking, Sweden still does remarkably well when it comes to...
So if you're a decision maker in Sweden, or a journalist, or a civic activist, or a judge, or anything else that is concerned with democracy, what kind of risks should you look at so that they don't get worse in the coming 5-10 years, would you say, if you look at the state of Swedish democracy at the moment?
Polarization, for sure. Polarization, for sure, because polarization has a toxic effect in democratic performance, basically because it makes it very difficult for political systems to build consensus to introduce reforms to solve the problems that people that people need to see a result. So if you're not able to build the majorities that will enable the political system to solve real problems for real people, in the long term, you'll be in trouble. And
But I think that the Swedish self-image is that we are a consensus country. So it's kind of the opposite to what you're saying.
I imagine that fundamentally this country remains consensus driven. All I'm saying is that the trend is towards increased polarization, and to a level that I, coming from the outside, I was not expecting to see, and I've been surprised to see. And generally speaking, that's not a welcome development in any democracy, including Sweden's.
Just to conclude, I mean, International IDEA has for many years been a guardian of democracy or and reporting on democracy and so on. And this is something that we see is under severe strain at the moment, this development. What gives you hope?
A few things, Anders. I already mentioned the fact that the vast majority of the world retain a demand for democracy. And this is not something that you only see in global opinion polls. I mean, you see it in very concrete ways. When you see what's happening with a youth-led protests in different places in Asia and Africa, even Latin America, protests that in many cases have toppled governments recently in places like Sri Lanka, like Nepal, like Bangladesh. It's very interesting that the demands that are voiced by young people are fundamentally democratic demands. I mean, they're not asking for the military to take over. They're not asking for authoritarian leadership to win the day. They are asking for democracy to fulfill its promise. So that gives me hope, and that's connected to a finding that has, you know, been a part of our reports for the past few years, which is that the participatory component of democracy, unlike the representative component of democracy that is under severe challenges, the participatory component of democracy, the civic engagement of people all over the world, remains very robust and very resilient. So if you ask me, that's where the democratic energy is to be found, in civic activism. I mean, people continue to go out on the streets, continue to organize themselves to defend their rights as they see them.
But the civic activism is under severe attack. I mean, it's also attacked in Sweden, for example, during the demonstration for Palestine, for example, that was attacked from high government officials.
The quality of civic space is under strain as well. But so is civic energy. I mean, in some ways, the fact that civic space has been for the past few years, you know, in the crosshairs of many governments in the world is a testament to the vitality of civic energy that they are confronted with. So both things can be true at the same time. I mean, there's a lot of civic energy around, but that civic energy and its manifestations are under severe challenges as well. I mean, both things can be true.
Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Du har lyssnat på en podcast från Aftonbladet. Ansvarig utgivare är Lotta Folker.